This programme was made with the support of the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland. 6 foot six above sea level. I grab the mic because I like to take you to another mental level. Low power frequency radio modulation. The big sound from underground, another pirate station. We bring the truth to places truth is never heard before. We bring the sound communication of our tribal war. Dark vision fly by helicopters in the night. Attempt triangulation of our station in the fight. Straight from the base, deep down, low precision. In the first program of telling our own story, we had the opportunity to hear some of those that tried to give a voice to the communities on the northeast of Dublin in the 80s. And by the early 90s, community media was expected to have been legalised. Jack Bourne put us in context.
One of the reasons we closed down in 88 was that Ray Burke, who was Minister for Communications, assured us, not just us, but all of the pirates, that once we all closed down, he would start issuing licences to the closey downers. But of course he gave licenses to the commercial pirates who had closed down. They got licenses. So we were then off the air and battling. Ray Burke had given me a bill. I spoke to him several times and he explained to me it was light touch regulation. I often said afterwards it was bloody light. We didn't feel a thing. He said, let's set up commercial radio and then we'll bring in community radio. But the IRTC, which is the forerunner of the BAI at that time, did not want to do community radio.
So the relation with official Ireland was not getting any better. The pirate radios were gone and the licence for community media were not forthcoming. When we get into the 90s, the campaign for licences gets an international dimension with the AMARC conference in Dublin. Again, Jack Bourne tells us how that came about.
Well, as I say, AMARC is an acronym for Community Radio Globally. It's a French acronym. And it was set up in Montreal with, again, a cooperative community radio station set up the meeting. And we sent a person from Ireland to attend that first meeting. And we've been involved since 1980 with AMARC. And it's quickly turned into a global movement because I don't think even the people in Montreal realised how widespread there was a yearning for doing community media. And I didn't know, because I thought to some extent this was a mad idea few of us here had, but people all over the planet were exploring this use of technology, and they came together very quickly and saw the strength of that kind of unity. And as I say, AMARC generally held every 2 years a global conference, and they tended to pick quite politically a location in solidarity with groups. And in 88 they went to Nicaragua with the Sandinista government, which was under a lot of pressure from the US at the time. So AMARC was there. We had two delegates from Ireland there who lobbied and proposed that AMARC in 1990 would come to Dublin because we were having trouble with the authorities here who were hell-bent on denying community radio to Ireland. So we had the conference in Dublin in 1990. And quite cynically, the IRTC issued an ad in the National Dailies saying they were about to embark on licensing community radio. This was about a month before the AMARC conference in 1990. And I think it was meant to stall any sort of trouble at the conference or misgivings or outcries of not looking after community radio. And as I say, the cynical part of it was that as soon as the conference was over, they announced that they'd changed their mind and they weren't going to do that. So it was quite a cynical ploy by the IRTC at the time. But the conference, nevertheless, copper fastened us, and it gave us a lot of new people who came from all over the island, north and south, to get together to develop community radio. So the AMARC conference has been quite an important vehicle for promoting community radio all around the planet.
With that background of resistance from officialdom, Near FM chairman Vincent Teeling and Marion Vickers from the Northside Partnership give us a flavour of the struggle for a licence.
I think the licensing process was extremely difficult in the sense of getting the authority to understand what we were about and what we were wanting to do with radio, what we wanted to do with a transmission system. It was a very difficult process and a lot of lobbying in the background. But more than lobbying, it's a change in how people would view what you wanted to do. It's changing that mindset of, do they want to be a radio station? Do they want to have DJs? To what we actually wanted to use radio for. That was very, very challenging.
It was certainly the early 90s. And almost from that day, we've been, I suppose, hooked to what the community radio is trying to achieve. And that's what over 20 years now. We did get involved on a number of occasions trying to establish, say, audience listenership, and we co-funded that. It certainly proved that there was an audience there. And one of the most important things about Near FM, one of the enduring things, is that it's always stayed steadfast to its mission of being a community. It's about the community. It's about representing the community. And I think that that's been its strength. And it's certainly, no matter where I go, it's held up as an example of what community radio should be. And I really do put that down to the founders, who were so passionate.
Marion Vickers talks about the passion of those early funders, and certainly there was no stopping Jack Byrne and the rest of those early visionaries. They say that when there's a will, there's a way. And for community media, the way happened to be current Doris and Uachtaráin, Michael D. Higgins.
Basically, it wouldn't have happened at all, I have to say. I've been bad-mouthing politicians, but after Michael D. Higgins was Minister for Communications, and I met him actually in Durrisbuie, next door to us here in the station. And I knew him over the years, but I took him aside as the new Minister for Communications and explained to him the difficulties we were having. He understood the philosophical position. I didn't have to explain community radio, the ethos, to him. He understood it. Instinctively, he understood it. And within a month or so, we were getting calls to come into the BCI at the time to talk about licensing community radio. And then they decided to put together a pilot of 11 community groups to run 11 pilots. Near was one of those. Only one collapsed of the 11, so 10 survived in Dublin and around the country. And once it went through the 18-month pilot phase, the BCI then decided, yeah, the model looks like it's viable, and they would continue to develop and roll it out.
But as DCU professor Colin Kenny will point out, it wouldn't be fair to say that everybody in the regulatory agencies were against the emerging community media. And as an example, we hear Ciarán Cassán's views, somebody who has seen the evolution of community media since the 90s from the regulatory agency's perspective, first as a member of the BCI and currently as a senior manager of the BAI.
There were always members of the IRTC who were very sympathetic to community radio, and I'm glad that it has developed.
Since community radio emerged as a separate strand in 1995, it has added to the plurality of voices that are on air across Ireland. It has also provided significant opportunity for people to develop their skills, and it has provided opportunities for communities to access the airwaves across the country in a way that wouldn't have been there had the community broadcasting sector not developed.
Jack Byrne again brings us to that period in the wilderness between the last emissions in 1988 and the first provision licence in 1995. It wasn't an easy one.
Because I used the credit union as a model, I already had a good, effective working model there. So there was a committee of management and we delegated tasks. We needed a treasurer, we needed a secretary. Because we were a cooperative, and we were a cooperative long before we got a licence, we were a cooperative from 1980. So we always ran it as a good governance structures, even when we were in the wilderness with no license and no radio station, even the pirate one. We ran a cooperative model. I mean, part of my problem in those early gloomy days was to sustain enthusiasm when people met and planned and there was no activity, nothing actually happening. And it's very hard to maintain enthusiasm, but we managed it somehow. So from the early 80s, we understood that governance was a necessary prerequisite to any successful enterprise. So when we got to the license, it was second nature to us to run the license station as a well-governed entity. We were 15 years running the cooperative without a license. Now, people came and went during that period, and I was unfortunately still there. Maybe somebody else would say definitely unfortunately, but I was there, and one or two others were there. But there were enough in the group in 1995 who had several years experience of running an entity, and it was the legal entity. Every year we had to have our books audited and have an AGM, so we did all that sort of administrative work, often with no sign that we were ever going to be successful. But so once the licence came along, the licence was just another piece of work.
And Dave O'Connor was one of those committee members who stuck around through thick and thin.
I got involved with the committee. I was used to committees because I'm probably very like my father, Joe, because he was always involved with committees. And I was involved with the youth club committee. I've been involved with the scouts committee. I was always involved with committees of some sort. So the notion of having a committee attracted me. I thought, this is great. It's a democratic process. There's not one person making decisions. It's actually done by a group of people coming together. So I got involved with the committee, and we used to meet, I remember, every Sunday morning in the old Walden buildings. And I just got involved, whatever needs to be done. Like they might talk about going out and organising a local meeting for, you know, encouraging people to get involved with community radio, because we needed to lobby the government at the time. So I remember standing in the halls, usually empty halls, in Donalmead, up in the old Black Sheep pub up in Coolock, trying to enthuse people. And I presume, you know, the reason I was used in so many ways is because I was a young person as well. And, you know, you need young people a lot of times to entice people in, because sometimes you can see the notion of committees and even at that stage, radio has been for much older people. And there still is that problem nowadays that committees tend to be full of. Well, I've probably become old myself in my 40s, I suppose. I've hit that stage now where I'm looking for young people to join.
But what difference did it make to have a licence? Why all this work to be recognised? And what did it mean? Jack and Vincent give us their take on it.
There's no comparison. I mean, pirate radio was winging it. I mean, we didn't have to report to anybody. We could make it up as we went along. To some extent, the pirate thing appealed more to my anarchistic sort of streak. But I used to talk to funders, and it seemed it would have been nice to have got some public monies, but there was no way as a pirate we could get access to public monies. So I suppose purely on a pragmatic basis rather than any other reason, I think it also, we felt it would sort of legitimate community radio. It would be a next step out of the wilderness into being recognised by the state. I just felt it was another step, a progression. Others bemoaned it as a retrograde step. For me, the jury is still out on it, but it did entail a great deal of extra paperwork, administrative work, reporting, accountability, all of that sort of stuff that we didn't ever have to do before, because we weren't accountable to anybody, only ourselves and our listeners. But now we had Big Brother, the state. I didn't mind that if the trade-off was that they would resources, but in a way we got all the administrative headaches, but with limited resources. So there's still work to be done in terms of justifying going for licences and being made legitimate.
I wonder whether starting the actual whole area around the Near Media Co-op and Near FM maybe was an easier part than our previous existence, I suppose, prior to licensing days and so on and so forth. It was a completely different ball game, a different setup really prior to that time. That had its own challenges too. We were then setting up a regulated radio station where we had to meet certain regulation. A regulation that we always demystified, this whole concept that radio and technology was some kind of mystery, where it's not any kind of a mystery. You get the necessary equipment and you push the buttons and the equipment works. I think we always took the viewpoint from the very, very early days that we were all amateurs in what we did. We did it because of the love of it. And not to be confused with this idea, oh, you're not professional. We were actually more than the term professional, because we actually loved what we did. And I always took the viewpoint that those who loved what they did deserved to have the best equipment and the best facilities available to them, even more so than if they were being paid to do it. And I think taking that viewpoint meant that we really, really pushed it and pushed it and pushed it to always have the best. And I would like to think today that, in general, we would have a setup that would be as good as anywhere.
The work was not over. And to prove that, we will hear the first impressions of Declan McLaughlin, currently working for the BAI, but at the time a young graduate looking for his first job.
My first job was actually with Near FM back in, it would have been, I think I started in August 1995. I just finished college and looking for something to do with my life, and I got into the local FOSS offices and said, you know, this, what are you interested in? You know, what floats your boat? And I said, well, you know, journalism would be interesting. As it happened, Near FM were hiring staff under the FOSS Community Employment Scheme at the time. And within about a couple of weeks, I found myself in an empty office with no equipment, just me and Derek Byrne. I think we were the first two staff in the building. So that's kind of my first encounter. And I was there for 3 years as a volunteer, as a community employment staff member, and also as a FOSS supervisor. So that's kind of where I started. Before then, I would never have thought that you could actually make radio programs, that you'd be, well, that you'd be allowed, or that you'd even have the ability. You know, it's one of those things I saw over the years. As I was there over the 3 or 4 years, I saw people take the same journey I took, where you go from being somebody who's terrified by a microphone, doesn't know how radio programs are made, doesn't know whether you're going to get them done on time, don't know whether you're going to have anything to put on air. All of those very basic kind of fears that you have when you start making radio, plus the challenge of making it meaningful for the community. And yet over time, by the time you leave, you know, you can talk into a microphone, you can walk into a studio with little notice if you need to, you can, not that you should, but you can do things on the fly, and you're very, very comfortable with how to make a radio program and how to make a radio program that hopefully says something about your community. I went through that journey and I saw other people go through that journey, and that was very rewarding for me.
Is it about time to ask an academic to put into words what community media aspiration should be? DCU Professor Colm Kenny.
The whole concept of community media in general is one that people need to understand, because it has a lot to offer. And it's a way of not just providing information about where we live and the world that actually surrounds us, but it's also a means of exploring that world and of learning about the media. Because I think that when people become involved in a community radio station or a community television station, it opens their eyes to the way the media in general presents information to them. So it just doesn't empower them to talk about their own community. It actually empowers them to better understand the way they can be manipulated or informed. People are very naive in respect of the media generally. They kind of take it as a given. They don't even recognise how much editing that goes on in a programme. It's a kind of innocence at large. Whether they can tell the difference between a community station and a commercial station depends what's on it. There are some very good commercial stations that do very good, interesting, relevant programmes. But I would expect that a community station should be providing them, as any good radio station will, with specific information that they can't get elsewhere, or that they're not getting elsewhere because people don't want to give it to them. A community station won't be as influenced by commercial considerations, I hope. And also it should be a place to explore angles of stories and types of stories that are not finding room in the other media for one reason or another.
Now it is time to put Near FM and its ethos into that context of community media. Vincent Healing, Declan McLaughlin and Jack Bourne give us their view on how Near Media Co-op fits into the Irish media landscape.
We moved very, very quickly, I think, from being a community radio station to being a movement with ideals that we wanted to follow. And I think it set us up in whatever way during the break in transmission while we awaited the Broadcast Act and the changes to SAME that allowed for licensing, that by the time we had gone back on air as a, what I remember, a weekend station as Near, we were then a movement. The whole idea of it being a movement developed over a series of time, but it was a very natural type of change.
You didn't really have a choice. I mean, Jack was very clear about, and the other board members, Vincent and Dave and Brendan and the other board members, very clear about what the station was about and that it wasn't. You know, one of the things I still remember from the time was that it's about community, it wasn't about radio. And I think that was very clear from the very beginning in terms of how the station worked. And I think it's something that they worked through over the years, that tension between trying to get listeners, to some extent, trying to get people involved, and also trying to serve a community. It was always a tension in the early days with volunteers, as people got to, you know, understand what the very idea was about. But yeah, very clear about it, and something I think that's stayed with me over the years. And when I look at other community radio stations, I think to myself, well, are they community or are they radio? And I think depending on where they fall will impact on how successful they are, and also whether they survive, I think, in the long term.
Well, NEAR is actually another acronym. It's for Northeast Access Radio. We thought we were being clever. We were very local and very near. Our franchise area is Northeast Dublin, from sort of Fairview up to Howth and swinging around and down the Swords Road. The idea of community radio is that it's small. That's exactly where we need to be to do our work effectively. So NEAR is the broadcasting service for Northeast Dublin. So if we were all Dublin, we wouldn't be able to deal with as regularly with agencies in Northeast Dublin as we can. So I think being very local and accessible is a really important part of what we do. And I think over the years, we've built up good relationship and respect from the community organisations, community voluntary sector and the statutory bodies in the area. They know we treat them fairly. They are not grilled. They'll be asked the questions, but we're not here for the fireworks of making a show of them. We're here about community development. We're here about supporting what people do and what people's aspirations are. And I think we have provided a very good service. I think the fact that we're still here and people still turn up to be interviewed shows that they appreciate the existence of NEAR FM. Why say words that I do not mean? They'll only serve to amuse,
ridicule and destroy, hardly ever teach. Jack just mentioned people turning up for interviews. But interviewees don't always have the luxury of advance notice, as NEAR FM presenters are often open to facilitate access to the radio.
But I was reminded in the early days when the partnership was much smaller and we had a meeting room on the same corridor as the radio station, and the Mexican ambassador came out to hear about the work of Northside Partnership. He'd been directed by Foreign Affairs, so he was a very trendy ambassador. And I remember he wore cowboy boots, very kind of informal kind of a character, very warm, charismatic kind of an individual. We were in the middle of the week and he says, "Oh, I have something in my car I want to show you." So off he went, and we were all waiting for him to come back, and he didn't appear for a lot. We thought he'd been kidnapped or something, for about 30 minutes. And eventually he came back and we all looked at him and said, "Are you okay?" He said, "I've just been interviewed by the radio station." Apparently he took the wrong door, put his head around the door, and he said, "Where am I?" And whoever was in the studio at the time said, "Who are you?" And he says, "I'm the Mexican ambassador." And he was dragged through the door and interviewed extensively. So he was just overwhelmed by this. He thought it was great. And for him, again, it was about confirming how important it is to have things like the radio station, the partnership, operating in communities and making things real for community. But as is the radio, NEAR FM has grown from strength to strength. And I think the most important thing about it is that it actually is supported by all of us in the community, because it's really so important. I couldn't praise it strongly enough. It's everybody that you meet from the radio station. Our own, one of our directors who was nominated by NEAR FM as a community director, Declan Cahill, is now a director of Northside Partnership. So it kind of cements the connections between the organisations. And Declan himself is quite an inspiring character in terms of his belief about the station. And everybody you meet has that kind of vision and that ethos down through the years. Because I suppose I've been seeing this all through those years. I think it's great.
That was Marion Vickers from the Northside Partnership, with one of her early memories of NEAR FM and her views of the station over the years. Now it is time to listen to the opinion of Kieran Cassand from the BEI, and he's going to give us his take on what it meant for the Irish media landscape, the eruption of the community media.
Since community radio emerged as a separate strand in 1995, it has added to the plurality of voices that are on air across Ireland. It has also provided significant opportunity for people to develop their skills, and it has provided opportunities for communities to access the airwaves across the country in a way that wouldn't have been there had the community broadcasting sector not developed.
Plurality of voices. Let's demonstrate that Kieran knows what he's talking about, as NEAR FM from the beginning had a very wide concept of what was local, and the range of voices that could be heard on air in the 90s was already a reflection of the new Irish society.
Hello, my name is Cabrini Gibbons. I'm from the Irish Refugee Council.
My name is David Joyce. I'm Development Education Officer with the Irish Congress of Trade Unions.
My name is Nolene Hartigan. I'm the Social Policy and Research Coordinator for the Simon Communities of Ireland. Simon has been working in Ireland for over 30 years to combat homelessness and provide services to homeless people.
My name is Jean-Pierre Iyanga. I work with Integrating Ireland, which is the national network of refugee, asylum seeker and immigrant support groups.
My name is Mercy Ebun-Peters and I'm from Sierra Leone, West Africa, and I worked as a regional reporter in West Africa as a journalist, and since coming to Ireland in I think 2000 or so, I've worked in community development, and it's my passion because I want to see my community grow and prosper.
My name is Kensika Moshengo and I work for the NCCRI, which is the National Consultative Committee on Racism and Intercultural. Some of the people will get into an organization, maybe that's the first time for them in their whole life to speak to a black person, you know? As simple as that. A lot of places I've been, maybe some people have admitted that, you know, in government departments or in civil servants. In many places, people very well educated, etc., working for 20 years in places, and they would admit that, oh, that's the first time for me to talk to a person who's, you know, who's black, who's from Africa, etc. For them, it's kind of a different exposure. It helps to dispel some of the myths that people have. I think this is just a simple example of, you know, just exposure to reality. You know, here I am, I'm real, you know. I'm not going to become white to please you, you know. This is who I am, and I think it's just the exposure. People have to be ready to face reality, really, not to live in some sort of a dream world where everybody is white, settled, Catholic, and eating potatoes and wearing iron jumper. This world doesn't exist.
And with that reality check provided by Kansika nearly 20 years ago, we have arrived at the end of the programme. We finished our first programme with the last emission of NDCR, so it is fitting to say goodbye with the first words of Dave O'Connor in the brand new Near FM that will pave the way for the third programme of Telling Our Own Story, where we will have the opportunity to learn about how Near Community Media developed in the first decade of the 21st century.
This is Northeast Access Radio, Near FM.
Good afternoon to you. This is indeed Dave O'Connor and welcome to a brand new programme on a brand new radio station. This is Off the Shelf on Near FM. In the next 2 hours, there's music, chat, computer news, a look at what's happening in the community and much more. And we kick off this beautiful, soft afternoon from the northeast Dublin summer of 95 to the west coast Californian summer of 65. Here they are, Mama Cass Elliott and the Mamas and Papas.
All the leaves are brown.
This programme was made with the support of the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland.